So, I guess the past couple of classes, I spoke about computing dark matter thermal freezeout. So today, I'd like to do two things. So the first is I'd like to give you some specific examples of dark matter thermal freezeout, in what is perhaps the most popular model for WIMP dark matter, which is the lightest supersymmetric partner in minimal supersymmetry. But one other thing I'd like to do today is tell you about some other so-called non-thermal mechanisms of dark matter production. So very often in the literature or when people talk about dark matter, they treat very often it sounds like the only way to get dark matter is this thermal freeze-out mechanism, and the dark matter has to be WIMP. That's not the case. There are lots of variations on just minimal thermal freeze-out. There's simple variations that just extend the minimal story I told you about earlier. And there are also more radical departures, where dark matter is produced very non-thermally, in the sense that the dark matter production isn't really related to the thermodynamic bath of standard model particles. So today, I want to illustrate a little bit more thermal freeze-out, but also tell you a little bit more about non-thermal mechanisms of getting the dark matter, just so you have an idea of what else is out there. Okay, but getting back to the most popular story, which is WIMP thermal freeze-out, I mentioned in the last class that we have the so-called WIMP miracle. And that is that if I have a new stable particle with mass close to the weak scale, so the dark matter chi mass is close to the W mass, and the dark matter interacts with the standard model, if my dark matter satisfies these two very simple properties, then it gives about the right relic density through just regular thermal freeze-out. All we need is some new heavy stable particle with these properties. And one very nice thing about this, and you will have encountered this in, I guess, in the BSM course, which is that we have lots of other reasons to expect new particles with precisely these properties. So there's the so-called electroweak hierarchy problem. And that is that the electroweak scale, the scale of the W and Z masses, is much, much smaller than other scales floating around, like the Planck scale or the Gut scale. And given that we have these larger scales, the electroweak scale seems to be unstable under quantum corrections. So we want to make the electroweak scale stable, and that typically involves putting in new physics close to the weak scale. And one of the most popular cases is supersymmetry. And often it gets shortened as just SUSY. And of course, given, well, if we have supersymmetry, that means that every particle we know of should have a superpartner with a spin differing by half a unit. So, in other words, for every standard model fermion, there should be a so-called sfermion, a spin zero. For every vector V mu, there should be a corresponding vector Eno. So every gauge boson, there should be a so-called gauge Eno. So these are spin one. This is spin one half. And for the standard model Higgs, the Higgs should also have a superpartner called the Higgs Eno. And this is spin zero, and the Higgs Eno partner is spin one half. And one more thing we need. In most cases, to make supersymmetry work out, at least phenomenologically, is something called R parity. And this is a discrete symmetry, a discrete reflection symmetry, such that the standard model is even, and all the standard model superpartners are odd. So by this tilde, I mean superpartner. And the nice thing about this is if I have supersymmetry plus R parity, this implies that the lightest superpartner is stable. And as long as this lightest superpartner is neutral under electromagnetism and a strong force, then it's going to have precisely these properties. And the usual abbreviation of this is LSP. So supersymmetry is one example. There are also other examples of theories that have these properties. Another example of a theory that has these properties, so I'll just put this in brackets before I move on, is something called UED, which stands for universal extra dimensions. And the idea here is that we have two boundaries in a five-dimensional space. And all the standard model fields are extended to bulk fields that live in this five-dimensional space, which is bounded by two 4D surfaces. And in this UED setup, you also have a reflection symmetry. About these two surfaces, about these two cold cell brains. And the upshot of that is that because each standard model field travels in the 5D space, each standard model particle, when we reduce the five-dimensional fields to four-dimensional fields, these five-dimensional fields reduce to a tower of four-dimensional KK modes. And because of this reflection symmetry, there's a so-called KK parity. So this reflection symmetry is called a KK parity. And one way to think about it is that within the bulk space, at least locally, we have momentum conservation in the five-dimensional direction. But because of these two boundaries, we actually break translation invariance in the extra dimension, but we keep a discrete reflection subgroup of that five-dimensional translation invariance. And the upshot of that is this remnant of momentum conservation is called KK parity, and the lightest n equals 1 KK mode turns out to be stable. And this lightest mode is called the LKP. So this is a second example of a theory where every standard model particle has lots of partner states from the new physics. And the theory also has a new reflection symmetry. And because of that, you also get a dark matter candidate. So this is the second example that's a bit different from supersymmetry. Yeah.
So the mass of the LKP is related to the size of its
dimension. Yep. So the so roughly the mass of an nth KK mode is going to be trying to remember if I need squares here or not. I think I need squares. It's going to be, well, at least for bosons, the standard model mass plus n pi over r squared, where r is the distance between the two brains. And it's just a flat geometry. Yeah. And typically, because we want the new stuff to come in around the electroweak scale, R inverse is typically on the order of a TeV. So the specific theory, in some ways, it's maybe less motivated than supersymmetry, but it is another example of a theory where you have new particles with similar properties to superpartners in supersymmetry. And the main difference here is here all the partner states have the same spin as their standard model counterparts because they're just KK modes, whereas in supersymmetry, all the spins differ by half a unit. And there are lots of other examples of BSM theories that have this kind of property, where standard model partners have some partner states, and the lightest partner state is stable. Yeah.
So this is one possible solution to the hierarchy problem. So this also explains why gravity is so weak.
No, it's actually not really a very good solution to the hierarchy problem. In some ways, it's kind of a straw man alternative to supersymmetry. In that the phenomenology of this theory is very, very similar to supersymmetry, except I don't have the flip spins. On the other hand, because this theory is five-dimensional, and because the size of the fifth dimension, the flat fifth dimension, is about a TeV, that means that the whole structure of the theory, we don't know what the structure of the theory is at energies above about 4 pi times a TeV. So what's happening here is just that I have a theory with a built-in best before date. I have a theory with a built-in energy scale at which it falls apart. And that energy scale corresponds to, is low enough that the standard model is fine up until that cutoff. So it doesn't actually solve the hierarchy problem. It just says that something crazy happens that we don't know how to explain at an energy that's not so high, that there just isn't a hierarchy problem because we just don't know how to describe the theory in the first place. So maybe you could take this and match it onto some kind of string theory at a few TeV, but it doesn't actually solve the hierarchy problem. Okay, but in any case, I'm just mentioning this as sort of an alternative to supersymmetry in terms of the dark matter phenomenology. You guys learned about KK modes in your BSM course?
Yeah.
A little bit. Okay. Anyway, I mean, the specific structure of this theory isn't so important. All I really want you to take away from this is that this picture of supersymmetry, which I'm going to concentrate on here, the same story basically carries over to lots of other theories, where I just change, instead of super partner, I change it to KK partner. Instead of LSP, I change it to LKP. But the rest of the story goes through in about the same way. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the supersymmetric case to illustrate this so-called Wundt miracle, and to talk a little bit more about thermal freezeout. Because this is the situation that has the most interest, and it has been traditionally the most popular. And if you know how this story goes, it's easy to translate it to other theories. Okay, so going back to supersymmetry specifically, I'm going to concentrate on the MSSM. And this is the minimal. So this is the smallest possible supersymmetric extension of the standard model. And here, if we look through the set of superpartners of the standard model states, we want our lightest neutral particle. We want our LSP to be we want our LSP to be neutral and uncolored. And it turns out that the only really viable candidate in this case for dark matter is the so-called neutralino. In principle, you could also look at the so-called sneutrinos. The sneutrinos are the superpartners of the standard model neutrinos, but it turns out that they don't work very well as dark matter candidates, unless you start adding new stuff to the theory. So I'm going to concentrate on the neutralino LSP situation. So it turns out that there are four neutralinos and in the MSSM. And I'm going to label them chi0i, where I runs from 1 to 4. And the labeling is traditionally such that m chi 1 is lighter than m chi 2, lighter than m chi 3, m chi 4. Yes? Oh, I'm about to do that. Yeah, that's my next step. But the neutralinos, well, first of all, there are four fermions. There are four different fermions. And they're a mixture of superpartners of gauge bosons and Higgses. So yes, this is exactly what I was about to do next. And what these are they're mixtures of the superpartners to the U1 hypercharge. Gauge boson. So the superpartner of the V1Y hypercharge gauge boson is called the Beano. Or it's a gaugeino, and we usually call it a Beano. There's also the SU2. There's also the neutral component at the SU2 left, gaugeino. And what I mean about W0 is because this is SU2, it has an adjoint index, and the adjoint index runs from 1 to 3. And it turns out that the neutral state, if you take these SU2 states and you apply electroweak symmetry breaking, there's a neutral state that I call W0 that corresponds to the third component. And there's charge components, W plus or minus, that correspond to W to the 1 minus plus I W tilde 2 with a root 2 for normalization. So if I take my SU2 left gaugeinos, there are three of them corresponding to the three adjoint indices. And if I decompose them under electromagnetism after electroweak symmetry breaking, I get this W3 component is electrically neutral, and the combination of the 1 and 2 components have charges plus or minus 1. So this piece is what I mean here. And this is called the Wino. So Beano, Wino. And in the MSSM, I don't know if you saw this, but there are two Higgs bosons. So there are two Higgs doublets in the MSSM. And there are two neutral components in these doublets. They're fermions. And these two pieces are called the Higgsinos. So these states all come from stuff having different quantum numbers under the underlying SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry. But after electroweak symmetry breaking, all of these states mix with each other. All these states mix with each other. So I guess I'm not sure how much you guys covered in your BSM course, but I assume you're told what gaugeinos and Higgsinos and so on. So in any case, these are our four neutralinos, and these four neutralinos are mixtures of these four initial states. So these are the so-called gauge eigenstates, and these are the four mass eigenstates. So starting from your Lagrangian, you write down your Lagrangian in terms of these four states, and these four states you find have a mass matrix it's a 4x4 matrix that connects them all, and when you diagonalize that mass matrix, your four mass eigenvalues are these. Okay, and we're specifically interested in the lightest neutralino, so the chi 0 1 state. And we're going to assume that chi 0 1 state is the LSP of the theory. So chi 0 1 is the LSP. Now, it doesn't have to be the LSP. In a generic supersymmetric theory, if you recall, in supersymmetry, some parts of the superpartner masses come from electroweak symmetry breaking, and some part of the superpartner masses come from supersymmetry breaking. So one part comes from electroweak symmetry breaking, the other part comes from supersymmetry breaking, and typically the supersymmetry breaking masses beat out the electroweak symmetry breaking masses. And that's what makes the superpartners heavier than the standard model states. And depending on the spectrum of the supersymmetry breaking parameters, the supersymmetry breaking masses, and so on, you'll get different spectra of superpartners. But in many cases, the spectrum of superpartners is such that Your lightest neutralino is the LSP of the theory. And this is good because it's a nice dark matter candidate. So in general, we can write our chi01 state as a linear combination of the Beano. We know Higgsino down and Higgsino up. And these ends come from, these ends turn out to be elements of a unitary matrix. And it turns out that if I, because of unitarity, the magnitudes of these four values sum to one. Just in the same way that if I took a some quantum state and I expanded it in terms of eigenstates, the coefficients of those eigenstates should sum to one to get the normalization. Right, so in any case, what I do is I start off with Lagrangian, and the first thing I do with my Lagrangian is after electric symmetry breaking, I find the mass matrices. And for those mass matrices, I diagonalize them and find the mass eigenstates. And once I have the mass eigenstates, I can then go and find the interactions among these mass eigenstates. So the place where you start to figure out the interactions is to start off by looking at the interactions. Start off by looking at the interactions between the gauge eigenstates, and then re-express those gauge eigenstates by inverting this relation in terms of the mass eigenstates. So there are lots of examples of, I'll give you a few examples of supersymmetric interactions with superpartners. So one example is if I have a, how do I write this? So for example, the Beano is going to interact with fermions. This way. So for example, my Beano has interactions with fermions proportional to the hypercharge coupling times the hypercharge charge. And the coupling mixes the fermion superpartner with the fermion in the Beano. So this is a Yukawa interaction. And this, in fact, I can think of as a supersymmetrization of, so here's a Beano. Here's a fermion superpartner and the Beano. This is actually a supersymmetrization of the gauge interaction that we all know and love between fermion hypercharge gauge boson. So in the standard model I have this interaction, and in supersymmetry, because of supersymmetry, this interaction gets related to this interaction. Where instead of having a hypercharge gauge boson, I get a Beano. Instead of having a fermion here, I get a fermion superpartner. So that's one example. Another example I have is I could look at something like a Yukawa interaction. So for example, I could look at the top Yukawa interaction. And it turns out that there's a what do I want? There are various examples. I'll write it this way. So another example of a supersymmetric interaction, which generalizes a standard model Yukawa interaction, is this. So this is a Yukawa interaction in the sense that I have a left-handed top quark coming out. And then here, I have a right-handed top. And here, I have a Higgsino up. Yes?
So what is GY on the left?
It's the hypercharge gauge coupling.
Okay.
So this is the coupling. This is the charge.
Right. Oh, I see.
So in the same way that for electromagnetic coupling, I would have an E here and then a Q electromagnetic here. So this is just a hypercharge generalization of that. And the sub F means it's the hypercharge of the fermion. So for this interaction corresponds to the interaction I'd have in the standard model, where I'd have top left, top right interacting with the Higgs boson, or the Higgs up part of the Higgs boson. So these are two specific examples of supersymmetric interactions where I start from the standard model interaction and I go to the superpartner one, and similarly here. And there's actually a fairly generic prescription, and that is that for every standard model interaction, so for every standard model interaction, so for example, for every gauge vector interaction, you have a supersymmetric partner of this interaction where I take any two legs on the vertex and I supersymmetrize them. So the supersymmetrization of this is going to be, let's say I choose this leg and that leg, in which case this becomes a fermion. This becomes a fermion, so I leave that leg alone, and this leg becomes the gaugino. And I can do the same thing for Yukawa interactions. Given the Yukawa interaction, I can take any two legs and supersymmetrize them. So for the Yukawa interaction, what I've done here is I have this Yukawa interaction in the standard model, and I supersymmetrized it by turning this piece and this piece into superpartners. And I can also do the same thing with just regular gauge interactions. So for example, instead of supersymmetrizing this leg and this leg, I could have instead supersymmetrized that leg and that leg and left that one alone. So another example would be I could have the gauge interactions of the two fermions with the AMU. So I'm not going to bother writing out the whole Lagrangian because it gets to be a huge mess, but roughly this is where the interactions come from. So in any case, going back to looking at my neutralino, I can now look at the various channels that can contribute to neutralino annihilation. Because what I want to do ultimately is compute the relic density of the neutralino LSP. And for that, I have to think about all the ways the neutralino can annihilate. So it turns out that the annihilation is actually pretty complicated. So I'll just write down a few. In general, there's usually one or two channels that dominate. But from the get-go, it can be hard to know which channels actually are the most important ones. And because of this, people have developed various computer codes to compute the freeze-out cross-sections, the thermally averaged sigma Vs for supersymmetric theories. So these are useful tools that if you start doing research in this area, you'll probably end up using a bit. But just to give you an example of a few different annihilation channels, I can have I could have two neutralinos annihilate into a pair of Ws. W plus, W minus. And here the thing in the T channel is a so-called chargino. So just as I have neutralinos, I also have chargino's. And the chargino's come from these charged gauginos plus the charge components of the Higgsinos. So the chargino's are just like neutralinos, except they have charge. I guess that's probably fairly self-evident. So this is one example of an annihilation channel. Another example of an annihilation channel is I could just look at the gauge interactions, chi01, chi01. And chi01 can couple to a Z gauge boson. And the Z could go to fermion, antifermion. And this interaction just comes from the supersymmetrization of this kind of thing. So for example, the Z is a mixture of the B mu and the SU2. W mu. So this component becomes part of the Z, and this gives me a coupling of the Z to the Bino, which couples to my neutralino. So that's one example. Another example is I can annihilate to fermions through an intermediate fermion. Like so. So this is one example, but there are lots of other examples. I could also have diagrams like this where I have intermediate Higgses or so on. But anyway, there are gazillions of diagrams. Usually only a few dominate, but it can be hard to keep track of them all. So because of that, there's some popular codes to compute, to take these annihilations and put them in. Probably the most popular one is called Dark Susie. But there are lots of others. So one thing I forgot to mention that I do want to mention is that these chi zeros, for all the neutralinos, these neutralinos are so-called Majorana fermions. So this won't be too important for us. Well, I'll give you an example of where it is important in a few minutes, but for the most part, it's not too important. But one upshot of this Majorana fermion property is that there's no distinct antiparticle for a Majorana fermion. So the antiparticle of a Majorana fermion, which you usually think of as a chi-zero bar, turns out to be equivalent to just the Majorana fermion. So for each Majorana fermion, there are two spin states, but there's no distinct antiparticle. Whereas for a Dirac fermion, you would have two spin states, but you'd also have a distinct antiparticle. So for example, the electron is a Dirac fermion, and it has two spin states, and it has an antiparticle, which is distinct, which is a positron. Whereas there's no distinct antiparticle for these neutralinos. OK, so given these annihilation channels, you can say some things in some generality. And when you go off and you compute sigma v in these supersymmetric theories, there's sort of a standard thing that happens. So I can classify the nature of my neutralino LSP by which of these gauge eigenstates is the largest component of it. So for example, a mostly Beano LSP is one where this is the dominant component. And a mostly Weino, that's a dominant, and so on. So very often you'll hear people talk about mostly Beano LSP. And these mostly Beano LSPs usually, in most cases, give you too much dark matter. And recall, too large of a dark matter density corresponds to too small of a sigma v for annihilation. Because the more you annihilate, the more you depopulate the dark matter density. On the other hand, a mostly Weino or mostly Higgsino LSP annihilates too well. So this is a good rule of thumb. There's a so-called well-tempered case, or if you like, the Goldilocks, the just right case, which is, and this is roughly a roughly equal mixture of Beano, Wino, or Beano, Higgsino. So in the Goldilocks case, I tune my supersymmetric parameters such that I have about the same amount of Wino as Beano or Higgsino as Beano. And in this case, the too much or the too little balance out, and I get about the right amount. Although this can be a little bit tricky to do. Now, these are all typical results. And when I say typical results, it turns out that there are some special cases where the special cases produce more annihilation than you might otherwise get. So these special cases apply mostly to the mostly Beano case. So I'll say that the Beano-like LSP can work in some special cases. So let me tell you the two most popular special cases, because this comes up a lot in the literature. And again, hopefully having seen this, you'll be able to read papers of current up-to-date research and get an idea of what's going on. Okay, so the first special case is when the neutrino mass, the neutrino LSP mass, is roughly half the mass of some intermediate state. So let's say I look at a Higgs boson. So when this happens, the dominant diagram is frequently, the dominant annihilation diagram is frequently two neutrinos coupling through a Higgs in the S channel, which decays mainly to BB bar. So if I look at the amplitude for this process, the amplitude for this process is proportional to this propagator going through the middle. And that propagator going through the middle has the form I p squared minus mh squared. And I'm also going to include a width factor. So this last piece is the decay width. So the idea is that my dark matter is annihilating through an S-channel Higgs boson into BB bar. And when I compute the diagram, I get this propagator. And this p squared corresponds to the momentum transferred. So this p is the momentum going through here. And p is equal to the sum of the momenta, of the four momenta, of these two neutrinos going in. Now, for dark matter freeze-out, in dark matter freeze-out, remember that the freeze-out is typically happening when m over t is very large, meaning that the typical momenta of the incoming neutrinos are very small. And that means that the neutrinos are close to annihilating at rest. And because the neutrinos are very close to annihilating at rest, this p squared is roughly equal to 2 m chi squared. So the way I get this, so if the two neutrinos are annihilating at rest, I have, or at least if they're annihilating non-relativistically, my four momentum, the sum of the four momenta And the center of mass frame is going to be that. But these, if the neutralino is non-relativistic, are much, much less than the neutralino mass. So my p squared is roughly just 2m chi 1 squared. And if I have this relation, 2m chi 1 squared roughly equal to mh squared, this piece cancels, and I get a resonance. So if I look at the square of this propagator, if I look at the square of this propagator as a function of p squared, what it's going to look like is at small p squared, it's going to be roughly constant. And as p squared approaches mh squared, it's going to shoot up, and then it's going to fall off as 1 over p squared, as 1 over p to the fourth. And the place where it spikes up here corresponds to p squared equals to mh squared. And the smaller the decay width, the more it spikes. So one way to enhance the annihilation cross-section above what you might usually expect is to have the neutralino mass be very, very close to mh over 2. In that case, the value of the propagator, the value of the propagator factor you probe in the cross-section is going to be way up here. And you're going to get a very large enhancement of the cross-section. So this is called, for obvious reasons, resonant annihilation. So this is the first special case in which mostly Beano LSP can give you the right amount of dark matter because you enhance the annihilation cross-section through a resonance. So here, let me also mention that I had H0. The lightest Higgs boson as my S-channel state. In principle, you can have H0, or A0, but it's the A0 case that is actually studied the most. So if you recall in supersymmetry, you don't just have one Higgs boson. You have three neutral Higgs bosons plus one charged Higgs boson as physical states. And in this case, you have to concentrate on the neutral Higgs bosons because your neutralino annihilating is neutral as well. Oh, so in the MSSM, you have your Higgs states are H plus and minus, and you have two CP even Higgs states and one CP odd Higgs state. So the A is a CP odd one. So remember, I start off with HU and HD, and these are doublets. And the top component is my H plus. My bottom component is VU plus 1 over root 2. And because this is a complex field, I have a real part. And HD, I've got VD plus 1 over root 2. RD plus I AD H minus. Now, one combination of these pseudoscalars is the Goldstone boson. But the other combination is a physical state that mixes to give you A0. So these H0 and H, these small and big H are linear combinations of these Rs. And the A0 is a linear combination of the AUs. Trying to figure out how to get this middle. Okay, so that's special case number one. Special case number two. Special case number two is called co-annihilation. Okay, so for co-annihilation, I want you to step back and think about what we did previously for computing the freeze-out of the lattice neutralino. And if you recall back, we only wrote a Boltzmann equation for the dark matter particle. So in this case, we only wrote a Boltzmann equation for chi 01. On the other hand, we only wrote a Boltzmann equation for chi 01, and implicitly, we only considered one kind of process, and that was annihilation processes. And we only considered the processes of the form chi chi goes back and forth with standard model. Now here, though, because we're in supersymmetry, we don't just have the dark matter particle plus the standard model. We now have the dark matter particle plus the standard model plus all the other superpartners. And it turns out that in some cases, those other superpartners can play an important role in determining the relic density of chi as well. So one example that our previous treatment didn't include that is present for supersymmetry. Our previous treatment didn't include the process. I could have, for example, a fermion decay to a standard model fermion and the neutralino LSP. So this is another reaction that can create dark matter that we didn't include in our previous Boltzmann equations, where we only had dark matter going back and forth with the standard model. And this is one example. And then, of course, you can think of lots of other cases. Now, this kind of reaction is guaranteed to happen because it's allowed through R parity. And typically, it happens pretty quickly. But it can still be important in certain special cases. Now, before I tell you about how these reactions can be important, I want to first tell you that in most cases, they're not important at all. So in most cases, these other reactions are not important. Okay, and specifically, the case in which this reaction and other reactions involving fermions are not important, and what I mean by most cases, is when the fermion mass is considerably larger than the LSP neutralino mass. So here I'm talking about fermions, but this can also apply to any other superpartner. But I'll focus on this kind of fermion reaction for now. So when this is true, what happens is that the fermions are going to do their thing and freeze out before the neutralinos. So first of all, the fermions can freeze out on their own, independently of the neutralinos. But they can also decay to neutralinos. And they can also go through transfer reactions to produce neutralinos. So if this happens, the fermions freeze out on their own and decay to chi 01 well before now, even though in this case I have a new source of chi zeros, remember that before chi zero freezes out, it's still in thermodynamic equilibrium with the standard model plasma. So before freeze out, my chi 01 still maintains an equilibrium density. And part of maintaining that equilibrium is that if I'm dumping more chi's into the plasma than I would have otherwise, those chis are just going to equilibrate through their fast interactions with the standard model. So again, even if I'm sourcing chis, I still go to the equilibrium distribution as long as I don't dump too many chis in. On the other hand, if these fermion decays happen close to freeze-out, or if there are reactions that connect the fermions to the chis around freeze-out, the other superpartners can be important. And this ends up being called co-annihilation. Okay, so on the other hand, this kind of thing is important when the mass difference is small. In that, suppose the mass difference between these is less than, usually the place where it starts to matter is roughly 20% of the neutralino mass. So if the mass difference is less than about 20% of the neutralino mass, this kind of this kind of extra reaction is important. So above, I mentioned decays of this fermion into a fermion and a neutralino. Another way that neutralinos and fermions can interact is through transfer reactions like this, where these reactions are going back and forth. But the idea is that I can have two neutralinos annihilate into two fermions, or vice versa, two fermions can annihilate into two neutralinos. So I have that process. And then I also have the process of fermion going to fermion in neutralino. So in this case, in my Boltzmann equations, I also have to take into account all these other reactions. And this reaction especially can be very important, because around freeze-out, even if I don't have enough energy to go from standard model to dark matter, I may have enough energy to go from chi to fermion or back and forth, because the mass difference is very small. So I might still have enough probability on the Boltzmann tail to have this reaction be important. So I have this reaction. And then one further reaction I can have is I can have fermions annihilate through neutralinos, or even gluinos, into fermions. So I also have annihilation channels directly of fermions. And in many cases, this annihilation is much more efficient . So for example, if this fermion is a squark, this intermediate state can be a gluino, which means that this interaction would be a strong interaction, whereas my normal chi annihilation into the standard model would be a weak interaction. So if this channel is open, this channel is open, but this process tends to be much, much more efficient than the usual WIMP freeze-out thing. So what you can have pictorially, this isn't the whole story, but roughly what you can have is what we considered previously, chi 0 1 goes to standard model. This is the pathway we considered previously. But the other pathway you could have, if you have a small mass difference, or a second pathway you can have, is your chi could go to fermion antifermion, which could then annihilate the standard model. So instead of taking this path, I can take this path. That's one example And I could also have annihilation between initial one chi initial state and one fermion initial state, and so on. But the point is, with these extra reactions, you get a different path. And for example, this path can be much more efficient. So instead of just going through here, which is slow, I can go to here, which is pretty fast, and here, which is really fast. And the upshot of this is that these so-called co-annihilation processes can very efficiently reduce the relic density for a Beano-like LSP. So the second way to rescue a Beano LSP to get the right amount of dark matter is to have co-annihilation processes. And there are two cases that have been considered a lot, and that is Stau co-annihilation and Stop co-annihilation. So the Stau is a superpartner of the Tau, and usually it's a right-handed component. The Stop is a superpartner of the Top. And these processes can give you much, much more efficient annihilation of a Beano-like LSP than you get otherwise. So this is the second situation where you can rescue a Beano LSP through co-annihilation, through a special case of annihilation. Okay, so I don't want to go in and rederive the Boltzmann equations, but it's a fairly straightforward generalization of what we did before. And basically, to generalize the Boltzmann equation, I'll just write over here. To generalize the Boltzmann equation to include co-annihilation, all that you do is instead of just writing a Boltzmann equation for chi, you write a Boltzmann equation for the total number density of all superpartners. So in other words, you compute the Boltzmann equation for n, which I define to be the sum over all superpartners ni. So I write a Boltzmann equation for the summed number density of all the superpartners. So this would include the neutrinal LSP, but it would also include all the gay genos and fermions and all that. And the point is that if I compute the Boltzmann equation for this, this Boltzmann equation is also going to include the decays and the co-annihilations. And at the end of the day, any superpartner I produce has to either annihilate with other superpartners to the standard model, or produce a chi one. So if I track this, and I track this to t much, much smaller than t freeze out, what I'm going to end up with, because all the heavier superpartners decay into the lightest superpartners, or they annihilate, n is going to be equal to n chi at low temperatures below freeze out. So the point is, if I just follow this one quantity, instead of computing all the individual number densities, and I track it down to low temperatures, at low temperatures, it's going to coincide with the number density that I want. Because, for example, the number density of all fermions will transfer into number densities of chi's through decay. OK, so I think I'm out of time, but I wanted to wrap that up. But this is a specific example of the so-called WIMP miracle in action, the supersymmetry. And in some cases, the WIMP miracle works kind of right out of the box if I have a well-tempered Beano-Wino-Higgs-Zeno LSP. In other cases, I either get too little dark matter or too much. In the case where it looks like I have too much, these special cases can be important for the annihilation, and they can reduce my relic density by a lot.